Okay, thanks very much for inviting me. This has been a really stimulating and exciting conference. I'm going to try giving this talk in the style that Douglas and Ahmed pioneered. And I've never done this before, so we'll see how it goes. I'm sure I haven't elevated it to the same art that they have, and in particular, I haven't reached the point of vandalism yet, but I'm sure that will happen later. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about some ongoing work with Xuanhan Chang, Murat Kologlu, Peter Kravchuk, and Sasha Zhibyedov. And what we're trying to explore is what are the space of observables and what are the properties of those observables that live on a null plane in a CFT. In CFT, a null plane is conformally equivalent to a null cone. Another nice way to think about it is, for example, scry plus or scry minus. These types of questions have a lot of motivations. One is that observables living on null planes, in some sense, control the Regi limit of correlation functions in CFTs, and those have lots of interesting physical questions associated with them. Another motivation is that observables living on scry plus are natural in collider physics. So these define so-called event shapes, where you have some kind of process in the interior of Minkowski space, and you have detectors that live at scry plus, and you measure those detectors in some state. That's a very natural thing to do in collider physics. And an example might be energy correlation functions, where you measure the energy deposited in calorimeters at different angles on the celestial sphere. And yet another place where these kinds of observables show up is in information theoretic quantities. So for example, computing shape variations of entanglement entropy. So we'd like to understand these types of observables in a non-perturbative conformal field theory. And what does that mean in practice? Well, one thing that means for me is relating these observables to things in CFT that are more familiar, and we're at least relatively more comfortable with local operators and the local operator product expansion. And so the goal is going to be to relate these types of observables as closely as possible to that data. Okay, so those are the motivations. So the thing that I'm going to be focusing on in this talk, so by the way, I should say another motivation for giving this talk here is that I talked about the same subject almost exactly a year ago, where we had just started thinking about this problem, and I said some inaccurate things in that talk. So this is my chance to set the record straight. So in particular, there were some missing terms in the light ray OPE that I want to explain today. So we're going to consider this setup. We have a null plane, and then two local operators, each integrated over a null line on that null plane. And by performing a change of conformal frame, we can map that to this situation. So here the point X plays the role of the point at past null infinity in this picture. So if we go down to negative infinity, we would reach the point X. And in a different conformal frame, it just looks like some standard point. And then our local operators are integrated along null rays that emanate from X. So here, Z1 and Z2 are null vectors. So Z1 squared equals Z2 squared equals 0. And we're integrating starting from the same point, X. And we'd like to understand, in particular, the OPE of these kinds of null integrated operators. So I'm going to be interested in an expansion in the separation between these operators in the what I'll call the transverse direction. So this direction here I'll call Y, and this is what I'll call the transverse space. And in this picture, this will be an OPE expansion in the limit where Z1 approaches Z2. One of the reasons this type of question is interesting is because in trying to understand the physics of this situation, you necessarily relieve the regime of validity of the usual operator product expansion. So, of course, if we have the two operators that are just sitting next to each other, we can do the OPE between them. If there's space like separated, everything is fine. But once we start integrating like this, we necessarily leave the regime of validity of that operator product expansion. We explore other regimes like the Reggie regime. So it's not totally trivial to figure out what happens when the transverse separation between these null rays is small. Of course, in principle, as Daniel explained in this talk, everything in Lorentzian signature is determined by observables in Euclidean signature, so we can just compute a Euclidean signature and analytically continue. And that is essentially at the core of what I'm going to be doing, but the type of problem that arises is how do you do the analytic continuation in practice? And so the goal is coming up with some practical statements about what happens after that analytic continuation. Okay, so I'm going to have to introduce a little bit of technology. So first of all, throughout I'm going to be using index-free notation. So the idea here is that if you have some tensor, then you should contract the indices with a polarization vector. So here O is, let's say, a local operator that's a traceless symmetric tensor under the Lorentz group. And then I can introduce a null polarization vector. So here Z squared. Zero, contract all the indices of O with Z, and I get an object that is now labeled by a space-time point and a null direction, O of X comma Z. And if I start with a local operator, that's just some finite dimensional tensor under the Lorentz group, then by doing this, I'm going to end up with a polynomial in Z. But the nice thing about this language is that in this language, we can describe more general types of operators, and we'll see one in just a moment. So a more general type of operator that is not simply related to a local operator would just be a homogeneous function of Z. Okay? So it transforms in the same type of way under conformal transformations. The only difference is that we're going to relax the condition of it being polynomial in Z. And you'll see an example of that in a second. Yes?
I mean, that's not all the information that's in a generic tensor, right? Like, contract with different
Absolutely. So that's right. So for simplicity, I'm going to talk about the case where this is a traceless symmetric tensor. If it's not a traceless symmetric tensor, then you have to introduce a polarization vector for each row of the Young diagram. Okay. All right. So why is this notation useful? So let me rewrite the type of question that we're asking in terms of that notation. And so we're interested in these null integrated local operators. And there's a nice way to think about these in terms of a conformally invariant integral transform that I call the light transform. And let me just refine this formula a little bit. Okay, so the idea is that you start with your operator O of X comma Z, and in the light transform, you integrate it along some contour. And the way this integral works is that the operator O starts at the point X when alpha equals minus infinity, and then you integrate it along the Z direction, and it ends up at another point, X prime. This is a conformally invariant contour, and it turns out that, properly defined, this is a conformally invariant integral transform. So this is where this type of index-free notation is really going to help us a lot. Once we've used this language, so first of all, you can see that if you start with a regular old local operator, O, and you apply this transform, you end up with something that's definitely not a polynomial in Z anymore. But it's still labeled by X and Z, and you can work out how it transforms under conformal transformations, and in fact, it transforms like a primary. So by using this language, we can say that L is a conformally invariant transform, and it modifies the quantum numbers like this. It takes delta comma J to 1 minus J comma 1 minus delta. And it turns out that, so this is an example of a vial reflection, an affine vial reflection. In particular, you can check for yourself that it preserves the conformal Casimir eigenvalues, and therefore it's possible to have a transform, conformally invariant transform that does this to the quantum numbers. Okay, so by using the index-free notation, we are now able to consider these types of funny things that mix X and Z in interesting ways. And in this language, the thing that we're trying to study is the following object. So it's the light transform of some operator O1 times the light transform of an operator O2, where we put them at the same point X. So these light transform contours have the same starting point, but they're going off in different Z directions. So that's this picture here. So the idea is that we want to think of these null integrated operators as being labeled by the initial point of the null integral and the direction, and we're putting the initial points at the same place, and that gives this object. And then we're additionally going to ask what happens when the null directions get close to each other. Okay, so one nice thing about this notation is we can immediately see some properties of this object. One is that it's a primary at X, and the reason is that each of these things transforms like a primary operator at X, and we're sticking them, we're just taking a product of them, so the product transforms like a primary. And another thing you can see is a selection rule, which is that if we take two primary operators and we literally stick them at the same point, their dimensions have to add. And normally in CFT we can't do this because there are OPE singularities, but these are not local operators, they're non-local objects, and it turns out that we can stick them at the same point. And so their dimensions have to add, but their dimensions are related to the underlying spins in this way, and so that gives you a selection rule on J, which is the effective spin of the product of these objects. So as an example, so J equals J1 plus J2 minus 1, and two examples that we'll be interested in are the case where you have null integrated scalars, then the effective spin is minus 1. And if you have null integrated stress tensors, which would be the case where you have two average null energy operators, then the effective spin of that product is 3. Okay. So, yes.
But it looks like in your integral that you would actually end up with the full library, but you only want half of it. I don't understand.
You want a full light ray. So I sort of skipped over what the integration contour is, but the idea is that, so here's a Penrose diagram from Minkowski space. You start at some point X, and you start moving in the Z direction. And when alpha equals 0, you hit null infinity. But you're actually supposed to keep going. And so you keep going out of this point gray patch and into the next one.
Oh, I see.
Okay. And in the CFT, that's a reasonable thing to do, because you can make sense of, there's nothing special at null infinity. Yes, Daniel?
But that's the light ray you wanted in your, I mean, that's the one you got from that, the original one on the null plane.
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that this picture maps to one of these contours for one of the operators, where this guy goes in the Z1 direction, and then another one of these contours for the other operator, where it goes in the Z2 direction. And actually, this should all live on the Lorentzian cylinder, which is periodic, and it turns out that this guy is just going to come back in and end up at the same point. I don't know if that picture makes sense.
Okay. Can you talk about the transformations of these operators? Does Z also transform?
Yes. So the idea is that the question is, does Z transform? Yes. So the idea is that under conformal transformations, the rule is that conformal transformation gives you a local rescaling and a local rotation. Z transforms under that local rotation. Okay, so last time I gave this talk, I explained that the objects appearing in this operator product expansion are light ray operators, and that still turns out to be true. So let me review let me review what these light ray operators are. So the idea is that there exists a natural analytic continuation in spin, not of the operators of the conformal field theory, but of their light transforms. So it's natural to draw the spectrum of the CF, to plot the spectrum of the CFT in the following way. We can plot the spin J versus delta minus D over 2. And then the operators of the theory, the light ray operators of the theory, live on Regi trajectories, which are functions of continuous spin J. So these curves are Regi trajectories. And if you look at these Regi trajectories at integer spin, and in particular, I'm looking at the even spin Regi trajectories. So if we look at them at even integer spin, then there are points on these trajectories, these purple points, and those correspond to, their coordinates correspond to the spectrum of local operators in the CFT, but you should really think of them as the null integrals of local operators in the CFT. So for example, this point here, the lowest dimension operator with spin 2, represents the null integral of the stress sensor, or the average null energy operator. Let's see. So the thing that I explained last time I gave this talk is that in this OPE, there are other types of objects that show up. And the first natural thing that shows up is where you take this picture and you cut it not at the even spins, but at odd spins. So here, this if we slice through this picture at j equals 3, we get a set of things that appear in the light ray OPE of the average null energy operators. So you remember I said that the effective spin of a product of average null energy operators is 3. And so light ray operators at spin 3 are natural objects that can, in fact, do appear in the OPE of average null energy operators. And so what you actually get in this construction of light ray operators is an analytic continuation in spin of light transforms of things that appear in the OPE, the usual local OPE of O1 and O2. So we can picture that like this. If you write down the Lorentz representation of something in the O1, O2 OPE, then you get to take the first row. So the number of boxes in the first row is this spin capital J, and make it continuous. So these are the types of things that light ray operators are labeled by. And you can see there's another part of the Young diagram that's just sort of hanging out, which is everything below the first row. And that represents a representation of SOD minus 2, and that's what I'll call the transverse spin. So the transverse spin does not get analytically continued. It just sort of comes along for the ride. And so it means that light ray operators are labeled by essentially three quantum numbers, a dimension, a spin capital J, and a transverse spin little j. And for simplicity, I'm going to talk just restrict to the case where transverse spin itself is traceless symmetric tensor. Okay, so I could have added more rows to the Young diagram, and all the things that I say will go through, but for simplicity, I'm just going to talk about the case where we have a single row with a length little j. So these are some objects that one can define. It leads to a puzzle, which is that it doesn't seem like there are enough objects to describe this light ray OPE. So in particular, the problem is that the transverse spin in the local operator OPE is bounded. So as an example, if we look at scalars, then the only things appearing in the scalar-scalar OPE are single row Young diagrams, i.e. traceless symmetric tensors. And so the transverse spin is always 0. We can consider the stress tensor, and this can have things with where the first row has arbitrary length, but the second row has length at most 4, and so there's a bound on the transverse spin j less than or equal to 4. And so what this means is that if we take if we just naively take objects in this plot, this is called the Chu-Frauchi plot. If we take objects in the Chu-Frauchi plot, we cannot find objects with high transverse spin as long as we stick to light rays in the O1, O2 OPE. But the problem is that this object that we're trying to define is a product of two things that are point-like in the transverse space. So we have, here I'm drawing the celestial sphere. So the celestial sphere would be like what I get if I take that picture and I slice through the cone. And the idea is that each null right pierces a point on the celestial sphere. And in general, you're familiar with the rules of CFT. If you have two-point-like objects and you take their OPE, you get arbitrarily high spins in the OPE. Roughly speaking, I can take these 2 points and I can just spin them around each other any arbitrary amount that I want, and I should get something non-trivial. Okay. So this is a puzzle. What I want to do with the remaining time is describe what the missing objects are that resolve this puzzle. Any questions? Okay. So before I say the answer, I want to say some words about why this is an interesting question. One of the ideas here is that when we're moving away from the space of local operators, at least for me, it's kind of unknown territory, and we don't know what kinds of objects will appear. These light ray operators are, in some sense, new objects, but it's not clear whether they're all the new objects that appear in Lorentzian signature. In fact, they're probably not. So it's important to understand how many new objects there are and what kind of observables they control. And the nicest situation would be if there was some kind of economy of new objects where we didn't have to introduce too many of them. One goal is to try to understand whether this is the case. Probably I should have taken a lesson from Douglas and philosophized while I was erasing so that this thing can have time to dry. Okay, so it looks like we're missing something, and we want to know whether we are missing something, whether we need to add some new types of observables that are localized on null planes or not. It turns out that the answer is we don't exactly, but there's some tricky conformal representation theory that comes into obtaining that answer. To explain that, we need a brief interlude. I think this is actually going to help. I'm going to write on it now. Okay. All right. We're going to ask the question, so we have these Regge trajectories describing light ray operators. What is special about the local operators on these trajectories? What is special about the light transform of a local operator compared to a general light ray operator? Let's start with asking what's special about a local operator. One way to say what's special is that it satisfies a shortening condition. Let me start with the dumbest shortening condition you've ever seen, which is if we consider a scalar operator, then and we take a derivative with respect to z, we get 0. So this is just saying that a scalar local operator is independent of z. More generally, we get a shortening condition because of this fact that the local operators are supposed to be polynomials of z, not just some general function of z. For a local operator with spin, we can write an analogous shortening condition. So a local operator with spin n, let's say, spin n minus 1, if we take n derivatives of it with respect to z, then we get 0. One way of One way of phrasing this, a really highbrow way of phrasing this kind of obvious fact, is that this operator here defines some d prime, something I'll call d prime sub n, which just acts on the Lorentz indices. So it doesn't touch the dimension, and it reshuffles the Lorentz representation. So it takes something with spin n minus 1 and transfers spin 0, formally speaking, to something with spin minus 1 and transfers spin n. And it's a Lorentz invariant map that does that. Now, if this applied to a local operator were non-zero, it would violate irreducibility of the Lorentz representation of the local operator. So a really highbrow way to say why this shortening condition holds is that the local operator is transforms in a finite dimensional irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. And so if it didn't satisfy this condition, then we would have, that would be violated. Okay, so this defines a Lorentz invariant operator. And in particular, it's a really boring kind of conformally invariant operator. But we can get something a little less boring by considering what happens when we apply the light transform. So this is a conformally invariant differential operator. This is a conformally invariant integral operator. And one can integrate by parts and get a new operator dn satisfying this condition. And so this is now a conformally invariant differential operator. And as an example, dn looks like something like a product of derivatives with respect to x. And these conformally invariant differential operators are kind of interesting and kind of rare. Let me give you a possibly more familiar example of a conformally invariant differential operator. So one example is the exterior derivative. So the exterior derivative takes n forms to n minus one, n plus one forms. And it turns out that if it acts on n forms with dimension n, taking them to n forms with dimension n plus 1, then it's actually a conformally invariant map. And you're most familiar with this in the case of a conserved current, which is a d minus 1 form with dimension d minus 1. And so you apply d to it, that's a conformally invariant thing. And so you can say the condition d of j equals 0, and that's a conformally invariant condition. Most of these maps are not so interesting in unitary CFT because it's only the conserved current case where the things appearing here are above the unitarity bound. N forms with dimension n are usually below the unitarity bound, so we usually don't care about the existence of these maps. But they can show up in some interesting situations where you're studying conformal blocks and looking at the poles of conformal blocks as a function of delta. And then things that happen in the non-unitary regime are actually important. And so this differential operator is, in fact, one that has appeared before in the literature, understanding the pole structure of conformal blocks as a function of delta. So these are kind of special, special objects, but it appears here in a natural way. Part of the main punchline is that, so we have, okay, so we have this funny differential operator, and by construction, it gives a shortening condition for the light transform of a local operator. So this is a way of saying what's special about the purple points on that plot. They're killed by these dn's. They satisfy these shortening conditions. But now we can instead consider applying these differential operators to a more general light ray operator that still has integer spin but is not the light transform of a local operator. And this, in fact, has the quantum numbers to be the type of missing ingredient that we need. So this has the quantum numbers of a light ray operator, in this particular case, with spin minus 1 and transverse spin n. And this is the kind of thing that would be appropriate for appearing in the L of scalar OPE. So the idea is that I'm being a little schematic about what D does, but so it takes n derivatives with respect to z. So because of that, it sort of removes spin n. And then there are these indices here, and what you're supposed to do is project the indices onto the transverse direction. So it removes usual spin n and puts it in the transverse space. And so that's what is happening here. So the idea is that we have these interesting differential operators that act naturally on this space of light ray operators. And if we hit the purple points with these differential operators, we get zero. But if we hit the integer spin non-purple points, so the things in this picture with odd spin, then we get some interesting new objects, and those new things have precisely higher transverse spin. And so they're candidates for what can appear in the light ray OPE. And in fact, that it turns out these are precisely the missing things. So since I'm running out of time, let me just write our formula that corrects the false claims from last time. So the idea is that the light ray OPE contains the terms that I described last time, and those are the ones that are pictured there. And then there's an infinite series of other terms with higher transverse spin. And these other terms with higher transverse spin take a similar form, but they just have this funny conformally invariant differential operators applied to them. And what that means in this picture is that you're supposed to cut the picture not just at spin j equals 3, but also at j equals 5, j equals 7, and so on. And all of those objects appear in the light ray OPE. So So one interesting conclusion from this is a refinement of what was stated by Hoffman and Maldacena. So Hoffman and Maldacena studied this OPE in n equals 4 superring mills, and they explained why spin 3 objects should appear. But one thing that this makes clear is that there are actually also the dimensions of things appearing in the OPE also include spin 5, spin 7, spin 9, and so on objects. But those objects have higher spin in the transverse direction. The Hoffman-Maldacena result was used recently in a very nice paper studying shape deformations of entanglement entropy. They were interested in terms that could appear in the OPE and how that is related to saturation or non-saturation of the quantum real energy condition. And the conclusions from those papers are unchanged by this analysis. It's true that there are additional terms in the OPE. Those terms have higher transverse spin, and I don't know if they cared about the transverse spin of everything in that paper. But there's a theorem, Nachtmann's theorem, that says that the Reggie trajectories are essentially they have to remain above the unitarity bound for all continuous real spins. And what this means is that these higher transverse spin terms in the light ray OPE, while they're there, they come with higher dimensions than the low transverse spin terms, and therefore are subleading in the limit of interest where the two points get close to each other. So that's an example where these higher transverse spin terms are not so important. Another example where they're not important is in the checks that that we did in our original paper on this, studying event shapes in scalar states. So if you have a scalar excitation in Minkowski space, and you study energy correlation functions in this scalar state, there's a selection rule that tells you that these higher transfer spin terms will not appear. And in fact, that's the type of thing that's been studied in the QCD literature for the most part. They consider scalar states and look at energy-energy correlators in the states. What this means is that if one wants to go beyond that and consider non-scalar states and look at event shapes in non-scalar states, then these interesting higher spin observables should appear. And in particular, this should help one in organizing the QCD computation for more complicated event shapes. And so that's an interesting application of this that I'd like to think about more. And so I'll stop talking there. Thanks.
Conventional local operators, at least for me, the intuition behind OPE is through state operator correspondence, and that's kind of basis decomposition. So what is the, and that's how I understand also convergence there. So what is the analog of that here, and what is the statement about convergence of this OPE?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I don't know what the analog of that is here. So the state operator correspondence is a much more elegant way towards understanding the operator product expansion in Euclidean signature. And part of the weird situation here is that we don't have an obvious state operator correspondence that describes the space of states living on a null ray. And so none of those arguments apply, and we have to sort of bend over backwards to try to describe what's going on. And the philosophy of this program is to start with the things that we understand non-perturbatively, the local operators, and try to reach as far as we possibly can from that position. And so that's where these light ray operators come from. They're sort of not too far from local operators. You can analytically continue things that you know about local operators and understand these things.
We don't have that tool available in this case. And that's why, well, I didn't get to describe the proof of this thing, but that's why the proofs of these statements look very different, and we don't have, before you start out trying to do these computations, you don't have at least we currently don't have some kind of completeness relation that tells us everything that could possibly appear from the beginning.
But so is it expected to be convergent, this expansion?
Okay, great, yes. So this is almost certainly a convergent expansion. We've checked it at weak and strong coupling in n equals 4 Cyprian mills, and it works beautifully. I think that one might be able to state that to prove that it's a convergent expansion by bounding the matrix elements of these things, which can be done given some knowledge of the local operator spectrum.
But what is the intuition behind this convergence, given there is no state operator corresponding? So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it wasn't obvious that there should exist a convergent expansion, but I think there does. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Can you write an example, like in a free theory? Is it an integral? Is it maybe multiple integrals of some field operators or something? Or what do these things look like?
Yeah, great. So that's a great question, and I probably should have said that. So in a free theory, these observables are very natural. It's nice to think about them in terms of calorimeters. So if you have particles propagating out to null infinity, one thing you can do is you can measure their energies. And that's what the average null energy operator does. But you could also measure powers of their energies. And that's basically what this first Redshift trajectory does. It's a calorimeter that measures powers of energy. When you turn on interactions, those aren't infrared safe observables anymore. And so you need to renormalize them, and that's what causes the trajectory to shift a little bit away from the unitarity bound.
I meant of the new operators, the new operators that you've constructed.
Yeah.
That are not they're not the integral of phi. So what are they? There's some. Is there a formula for them?
Well, yeah. They're related to higher powers of the energy, I'm sure there's a formula. There's certainly a formula for them. So the idea is that, let's see. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe some measurement of energy that also is sensitive to the spin of the particle that's coming in. I'm not sure.
Should I expect that there would be a a generalization of the geodesic Witten diagram star for Lorentzian ADS CFD that comes from this, like null plane Witten diagrams?
Null plane Witten diagrams. Let's see. So you're essentially asking whether one can try a bulk derivation of this kind of formula?
Well, what I learned from the geodesic Witten diagram star is that there's a way of understanding what the OPE fusion does from the bulk point of view. So now you're studying the OPE of light ray operators. So let's say I'm doing Lorentzian ADS CFT. Is there an analogous star to be explored?
So as far as I understand the geodesic Witten diagram story, it's a way of taking into account symmetries. Right, the fact that the OPE block is given by this geodesic integral is a consequence of symmetries, and that's a nice way to understand it. So yeah, I mean, symmetries of course control each term, each primary, the way each primary appears in the OPE, and there might be a similar way to understand the structure of that OPE block.
So if you have the complete OPE of the two local operators, can you compute the right-hand side? I mean, it's just a repackaging of the local OPE, or there's more data here?
Well, yeah. So it depends how much data you have. So you need to know the analytic continuation of the data in the local OPE. That analytic continuation is unique, and you can compute it. Well, maybe you have different ways of computing it. One way would be if you really know the full data of the CFT, you can get the analytic continuation essentially using crossing symmetry and the Lorentzian inversion formula. But there may be other techniques. So for example, in N equals 4 Shapiro-Mills theory, they understand how to analytically continue the spectrum, but they don't understand all the OPE data. So in N equals 4 Shapiro-Mills, you can say precisely what the dimensions of all of the objects appearing here are.
And the related question, is there a crossing equation for this? If you consider.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's another interesting question. So you could consider a three-point energy correlator where you have three calorimeters and ask about OPEs between different calorimeters, and there is indeed an associativity condition for the light ray OPE. And that's another way of motivating why there needed to be new objects. We know very well from the usual crossing symmetry for local operators that associativity of the operator product expansion requires an infinite number of spins. You need double twist operators, and so the same argument here tells you that you need double twist light ray operators, and that's what these guys would become for sufficiently high transfer spin.
And do you think this can lead to some interesting booster problem?
I think that associativity of the light ray OPE should follow from associativity of the usual OPE, maybe with some interesting wrinkles and conformal representation theory, and who knows. But maybe another interesting question is whether one can formulate the bootstrap problem directly in terms of those objects and try to directly constrain Lorentzian physics without going through the usual operator spectrum. That's a very interesting question. I don't know the answer.
Okay, let's thank David again.